All right, welcome to Lecture 27. Today's topic is going to be Prince Henry the Navigator and Portuguese exploration, the crucial precursor to Columbus and the explosion of globalization that is going to arrive, which we will be looking at on Monday and thereafter. But before we get into that, I would like to keep on expanding on our thoughts and our awareness of the big picture, of the context in which all of this is happening, the story of mankind and all of its scope and complexity. And so we want to anchor our awareness of the story of Prince Henry and everything else that we encounter in history to this. We want to get out our thinking anchor and cast it off and connect it to this. If we can, then it's connected. Whatever it is that we are studying is connected to everything else and ultimately to the present. So, right, we are, for instance, to give you an example right now of what we are studying Prince Henry the Navigator, who's here on our timeline right about here. Okay? And about 1415. He's over here. Pardon my spelling. And 1415. Right? So we're talking about something that's happening in this area, in this realm. So evidently, if we are looking for a so what with regard to Portuguese exploration and American history, what are we going to do with it? To what do we connect Prince Henry? Why should we care? Or to what do we expect? We might not yet know. You might not yet know. But if we have this general awareness of history, where are we expecting this to go? Where is this leading to, the story of Prince Henry? Alexander.
Columbus discovers America.
It's leading to 1492, right? So what we're going to do is we're going to anchor to this. Okay? This is our anchor right here. There's my drawing of an anchor. Not bad, Mr. Powell. All right, so there's our anchor, and we're going to connect up to this anchor, and right, and then that connects up to where we are. So what happens is, let me take away those ugly annotations. Let's see if I can remove those. Oh, good. Even my beautiful anchor I'm going to get rid of. Okay, so what I wanted to say was, right, this one here, this is directly connected to this. It should be in our thinking if we have our so what clear. Our so what is, we live in an America-centric, globalized world. How did that come to be? The only way it came to be, the only way there is a USA, if there's a discovery of A. All right, so we've said that enough times, right? All right, so then who cares about Prince Henry? Well, In American history, we care because this leads to this. The work of Prince Henry and his Portuguese explorers sets the context for and makes it possible for Columbus to do what he's going to do. So we wouldn't study Prince Henry by himself, because what we would end up with is a story about somebody in Portugal exploring Africa. Now, so what? Right? At that point, there is no so what. But at that point, it's a dead end. Okay, assuming that we're talking about American history, and we're talking about mainly people who are living in an America-centric world, even if you're not living in the United States proper, but even, no matter where you are in the world, the so what for this, it's a dead end. And that's nothing against Prince Henry. There's plenty of stuff in the past plenty of wonderful people back there at all times in history. Nice, loving mommies and children and nice people who worked hard. And the so what for those people is nothing. It's not saying anything against them. It's just that we're over here. We are here, not somewhere else. So, and we don't have time for all of the 10 billion people that have ever lived in history. We just don't. So we're looking for connections to our world and our life here and now, understanding the world we live in and making our way through it. And so Prince Henry, he's only really connected to us indirectly. It's a connection. But he connects to us thanks to him. And he connects to us directly. Okay? So this is what we're studying now. This is an example of interconnection. Right? We're studying something that does not directly connect to us. It connects to us via another link that connects to us. So in order to kind of encourage you to think that way, what I wanted to do, there's an example from our studies today with Prince Henry, but what I wanted to do was do some interconnections with Manes Narmer. So how about, we know already a direct connection, okay? But let's do this connection. Connection between, do we know, can we think of, can we integrate the existence of Manes Narmer to Christopher Columbus? Any ideas? Based on anything that we've learned so far, do we have a connection? So that we can, I'm going to even change colors on that one. I want to do connections, direct connections in one color, and then I can't get a thicker. I want a thicker one. I can't get a thicker one in this particular program. But I'm going to change colors to red. And I say, okay, now what I want to do is I want to do interconnections. Okay, different layers. What do you think? Can we get from Manes Narmer to us in another way? Or we don't necessarily need that other link here. We just want to have a connection to Columbus. And Columbus, we already know, is connected to us. So this link already exists. Now we want the red one. Juliet, go ahead.
Well, without Columbus, there wouldn't ever have been a different way than monarchy. So it would always have been monarchy and not something else.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, that's a tough one. I think you're on the right track, Juliet. We can't really say that. We can't really say that without Columbus, because it's without the founding fathers. So Columbus, and that's what I'm driving at here, is who is this guy Columbus? What's the connection between Manes and Columbus? Timothy.
I have a connection Manes Narmer created monarchy, and the reason Columbus went on this voyage is because his king and queen, I think mostly the queen, right, told him to. So had monarchy not been created, Columbus may not have been, he might have not existed, but if he had, he probably wouldn't have been given orders to go on this mission.
Okay, you're right. That's excellent, Timothy. You're almost right, but I wouldn't put it the way you did. What I would put is this. Columbus had to get permission. It wasn't an order. It was a permission to come and find America, right? He was not free. Columbus was not free. We don't have freedom in 1492. We can make another connection there in just one second if we're thinking this through. We can make a connection over here. Okay, so Columbus was not free in 1492. If he wanted to go and explore, he needed to get permission from the Manes Narmer of his day. And that happened to be Queen Isabella of Castile. Thank you, Timothy. That's excellent. That's the connection. Monarchy is the connection. Okay? So how about the connection now between the fall of Rome and Columbus discovers America there? We can connect that in a number of different ways. But maybe we could do an interconnection. Rome, Menes, and Columbus. What's our web of knowledge there? Keen.
Okay, so I might struggle a little bit with this one, but I would say that from Menes to the fall of Rome, Menes' number is the beginning of monarchy, and the fall of Rome is sort of the return of the barbaric monarchy, the sort of extinguishing of the ideas that were brought up during the Roman Empire a number of years before it fell. And then going from the fall of Rome to Columbus discovers America, that one's a little bit more harder, but I think that if Rome had not fallen, we know that the world would not be European, and Columbus was a European. But also, the ideas of democracy and republic may not have been completely extinguished. Although Rome was an empire at the time that it fell, the ideas were much more accessible then than after the fall of Rome. And so it's possible that Columbus, you know, it may have been a different scenario if Columbus had the ideas not been extinguished.
All right. You're definitely, again, you're definitely on the right track. But we have to be careful about getting kind of caught up in a lot of complicated what-ifs. Let's just, it is possible to view this more in a more straightforward way, Keenan. That's what I want you to encourage you to do, because like with Timothy's example, see, we got Menes Narmer, we have the establishment of the historical norm, the precedent of monarchy within recorded history. It continues for all of history. And Columbus has a queen that he needs to get permission from. See, that's very straightforward. So again, let's take the same approach with the fall of Rome. And you did that quite well with the fall of Rome being the return of barbaric monarchy. Right? Because Rome had previously stood for something else. So the destruction of anything that Rome might have been before, that means we're going to go back and we're going to get the most raw and violent and barbaric form of monarchy again. We have to start again. We've got the Dark Ages again. So that's the first connection, and quite straightforward. And then the second connection, Keen, quite straightforward again, you don't have to overthink this, is that Columbus was European. Right? So we're going to have, and now we've got interconnection. Because Columbus is a European, because Rome falls because of European barbarians, and he's a European who must get the permission of a king. There we go. We're back to, you know, we're back, we're stuck in that kind of whole framework over here. And so thank goodness for Columbus, because he's going to discover America and make it possible for people who are way better than all these other bozos back there to come up with something new and wonderful. So that's great, right? So interconnection here, right? If we think about how these all link up together, it becomes amazing. It's not separate stuff. Priya, go ahead.
I was just going to follow up on Columbus. He didn't have to get it from that particular king and queen. He had to go a bunch of places, and they all didn't want it because they were fighting other people, and they didn't have the money to do it. And the king and queen of Spain themselves were fighting a war at the time and had to say no. They came back another time and said yes.
Oh, Bria, that's awesome. That is awesome. Did you see that connection? What kind of world was Columbus living in? He was living in this awful world, full of kings and queens doing just this, taking their clubs and beating up other people. That's awesome, Bria. So that's exactly right. 1492, why is it that Columbus sails in 1492? Because one of these episodes of violent monarchy was finally coming to an end. The Reconquista. One of these episodes of barbarism, of human beings fighting each other for tribal and all these other barbaric affiliations that can't get along with these. It's finally going to come to an end. We're going to get a breather, and the monarch is going to actually be inspired to try something else and send this explorer out there. Fantastic. That's a great one. You're exactly right, Bria. Good connection. All right, that's excellent. This is really good. I can tell that you guys are able to have these thoughts. They are abstract, right? It's a complicated thing. You have to be able to think about monarchy as such, and you move that template around, and you look in Europe, and you see monarchy, and you look back in Egypt, and you see it again, and you look in 1776, and you don't. And it's one of the things that we have to appreciate about Columbus and Prince Henry today that we're going to talk about is that monarchy is part of their context. And the concept of freedom is not. It's not there. So, to some extent, we have got to give them a little bit of appreciation of empathy. And we have to have historical empathy, which means it doesn't mean that we agree with them. And it doesn't even mean that we like some of what they stand for or what they do. But we have to understand that living back then in those times meant something and not something else. There was no America. And life, quite frankly, was not very civilized. So we cannot look at them and expect them to be us, which is what a lot of people nowadays I find are really silly when they think about Columbus or they think about things that happened in the past. It's as if they expect the people of the past to be them, which is ridiculous. They don't have any historical empathy for the people being who they were. Menes Narmer is who he was. He's living in a time that's a certain kind of time and a certain kind of culture. He's going to be that kind of person. It's only really, really revolutionary thinkers like the Founding Fathers who can change a civilization, who can define a new path, and get people to start thinking that something else is normal instead of what everybody else has. So it's so important for us to have this ability to survey history and to think about how these things all connect up and make proper judgments about the things that we're seeing in the past. We can do it if we have the big picture. So these interconnections here are part of that ability to put ourselves in the full context. All right, I'm liking what I'm seeing in terms of your responses are quite strong. That's really heartening. So good for you guys. I feel good about that. And let's keep looking for these. Let's keep looking for these types of interconnections as we go along, because that will strengthen our motivation to know these facts. Menes Narmer will not just be an Egyptian pharaoh to us. He will be an intimately connected member of the same group of people that were ruling the Roman Empire and that executed Jesus. The same people that were ruling Europe and gave Columbus permission to go to America. The same kind of people throughout history, wherever you look. Meanwhile, the Athenians, they're special. The Romans, they're special. They're innovators. They're imaginative, creative people that are coming up with wonderful innovations and thinking about a different way of life for human beings. Thank you. Because they're inspiring the Founding Fathers and creating an exception and a country that's going to rise up and become the greatest in the history of the world. Fantastic. Okay. So, these are interconnections. All right, let us get back to our main topic. Because I love the interconnections. The facts in and of themselves, that's boring. The meaning of the facts is where it's at. So I could talk interconnections all day. So, but anyway, let's get back to Prince Henry and this early context. I left you with a bit of a puzzle, right? Which was, how can you have Portugal become a middleman in world trade? So, and I'm going to extend that puzzle a little bit today. Let's go back to our map of, here's a good map to use to make this puzzle more compelling here, right? We've got China over here and India producing goods, Persia as well, producing exotic goods that are very difficult to obtain in Europe. And they're coming across by land and by sea into the Muslim merchants of the Middle East. And they are selling things to people like the Polos and families of Italian merchants who are pretty much the European middlemen in all of this. And these Italian merchants are then selling to the rest of Europe. And being a middleman is the most civilized way that people from the Dark Ages could imagine to obtain wealth, right? Because to be a middleman was you didn't have to make anything. What you had to do was connect buyers and sellers, get in the middle between them, and facilitate trade, just like Amazon does today and Walmart and all the other great companies out there facilitate the connection between the people that produce the values and the people that consume them. And so being a middleman was the most civilized way you could come up with to actually gain money in a time like this. The obvious one that we've talked about before was the barbaric method, the barbarian approach to obtaining wealth was to bash your neighbor's head in and take it from him. So, right, to kill people and take their stuff. Exactly. So Portugal now is a country that has been through an 800-year Reconquista. So we know, well, not quite yet in Prince Henry's time, right? Because it's 1415, so it's only been 700 years. Okay, only 700. Only 700 years of bashing people's heads in and taking back the stuff that they took from you in the first place. Reconquering, retaking. So they know plenty about that method and about, you know, looking at your neighbor not as another fellow human being that you would like to respect and trade with, but rather somebody that you hate and that you want to kill and take their stuff. And so that, you know, Portugal had plenty of practice with that. But how could Portugal become more of this kind of more civilized participant in the world and become a middleman? The geography is stacked against Portugal, isn't it? Because it's not even on our map. all of this stuff coming through the Silk Route, it's going through the Middle East. It's going through this region here. It's got to cross here in order to get into the Mediterranean. And even then, Portugal is at the end of the link. Portugal did not have a Mediterranean presence. So now our puzzle, we're going to have to solve our puzzle today as to how Portugal could become a middleman in world trade. So we can come back to this and we can get kind of some interesting answers, right? If we look down here and what we know happened in 1415, Prince Henry led a Portuguese force to Ceuta, a Muslim outpost in northern Africa, to conquer it. So we got the classic kill your neighbors and take his stuff. But on top of that, another interesting thing about Ceuta was its geographical location in a number of regards. Right? So one thing about Ceuta was, well, it's right there at the Strait of Gibraltar. So if you do want more access to Mediterranean trade, there can't be a better place to take over. Right? If you're Portugal, you're kind of stuck outside the Mediterranean looking in. So you get to Ceuta, you could start to have access to Mediterranean trade. But beyond that, what Prince Henry discovered about Ceuta was that being in Ceuta was perfect for being a middleman in African trade. Anything that was coming up here, ivory and gold and other products from sub-Saharan Africa, there wasn't a heck of a lot of it, but there was some. Anything that was coming from Africa to North Africa would go through Morocco, what it is today, right? What we call Ceuta up there. So it was a good spot to take advantage of being the middleman in that particular situation. But beyond that, You know, Prince Henry came upon another idea. And this is where he becomes kind of a special person in history. As opposed to a typical kind of bash your head in barbarian ruler like Menes Narmer, of which there are countless examples, right? He starts to become an interesting person in our story, not because of the conquest of Ceuta, but because of what he did afterwards. And what he was about that was different. Not what he was about that was the same as everybody else, but rather what he was thinking that was unique and special. And Prince Henry was not just a Dark Ages king, ruler type of guy. He was a duke, in fact. Remember, we have our picture of... Where's our picture of Prince Henry over here? Here he is. Prince Henry was a member of the royal family of Portugal, and he was Duke of Viseu. So that was his title, and so typical type of person in that regard. But what was not typical about Prince Henry was he was a Renaissance man. He was one of those rare people in this phase of the 1400s, still kind of stuck in the Dark Ages. France and England are fighting the Hundred Years' War. The Reconquista is still going on. It's still very much the Dark Ages. But meanwhile, there's some learning going on. There's more literacy. And there are some individuals who are reviving ancient knowledge. And Prince Henry in particular was fascinated by an ancient geographer and astronomer, an ancient Greek geographer and astronomer named Ptolemy. And so part of this story of the Renaissance, right, remember, is the revival of ancient science coming from ancient Greece in particular, and then being brought back and then, well, even being improved upon and stuff, right? But it's all being born back in ancient Greece. It dies off because of the Dark Ages and the fall of the Roman Empire and all that stuff. And then it takes a really, really long time for it to come back. So let's go back to our ancient Greeks and Ptolemy in particular. And I'll show you what the Greeks had managed to figure out about the world. So here is a map of the ancient, a map of the world produced by the Greek geographer Ptolemy. And then you can see that I've numbered a bunch of the features on here to help you navigate the map. And some of you have probably seen this before. So in particular here we have number one, right? This is crucial. If you know what number one is, you can start to get your mind wrapped around this map. So if dark blue is water and white is land, what's number one if this is a map of the world? Juliet?
Is it Italy?
Yeah, it's Italy, right. And up here then, this island, number two, would be what? Alexander?
Britain,
right, exactly. With Ireland up here, this other one right next to it would be Ireland. Okay, number three would be France. Number four, we're talking Holy Roman Empire, Germany, right? What's number five over here? Kind of two things at once, right, Keen?
That would be, what, Iberia?
Yeah, Iberia, Spain and Portugal, right? Okay, so these are, and six over here would be Constantinople, the gateway to Europe from Asia, okay? So, seven, Atlantic Ocean, eight, as a continental mass, is Africa, right? And 11 would be, nine is what? This line here, extending down, or indeed, starting over here and going down to the Mediterranean. Timothy?
The Nile.
The Nile River, right? Okay. So, and then 10 is the Indian Ocean. And 11, in a continental sense, would be Asia, but even though it's not very accurately portrayed, we're talking about India. Okay, so those of you who know your Asian geography, we have the Indus River, and we have the Ganges River, the two great rivers of the Indian subcontinent. We've got the Nile over here, right? Okay, good. So this is about as well. Yeah, that big, huge blob is supposed to be Sri Lanka. So evidently, you know, it's out of proportion. It's not well understood what the proportions of things are here, right? So it's really, really big. Bigger than it needs to be. And the shape of things is wrong down here. Like, this is supposed to be where Singapore is today, right down at the bottom of the Malay Peninsula. Lots of stuff that's interesting here. But you know, the point is, before satellites and before modern cartography, I mean, how are you supposed to know? You have to develop a method for actually going out into the world and recording your journeys and the relationships between objects in the world and the seas and how big they are and how long it takes to sail across them, how long it takes to walk across something and how big it is. And then you have to find a way to collect that into a reference frame and make a map out of it. This is a very non-obvious and challenging process of thought. And so it's remarkable that the Greeks were able to come up with this kind of thought, this kind of image of the world that they lived in. However flawed it was, of course, given the limitations of their knowledge. But so this is kind of where things peaked in ancient Greece. And during the Dark Ages, there wasn't any progress. So we know, of course, that we don't have anybody sailing across the big oceans and discovering new continents and figuring out the relationship between all of this and the rest of the world. So we're still, at first, you know, we're going to be talking about, with Prince Henry and everybody else, the old world, this limited view of the world, without any of the rest. But basically, during the Dark Ages, there hadn't been any progress beyond this. There was, this map was a map produced in 1154 by a Muslim geographer named Al-Idrisi. And it's obviously kind of a decorative map and very kind of curvy, and it's not meant to be as accurate in a sense, although maybe he couldn't be more accurate than this. This is Italy right here, for those of you who are trying to figure this one out, right? It's the same basic orientation. This is Iberia, right? And so up here, basically, we've got Europe. The center here in this map, that's Arabia right there. Okay? And again, the black line with its triple source at the bottom here is the Nile. And these are mountains, right? That's why you have rivers coming down from the mountains. And pretend mountains and pretend rivers over here for sure. I mean, this is all some goofy stuff going on here. And a lot of this is made up, and a lot of it's patently not true. A lot of it was just kind of what they believed. One thing that's interesting about what they believed in this map from the Dark Ages was something about Africa that the ancients did not know. And it's much more obviously depicted on this particular projection. Obviously, the shape of it is all wrong, right? So we can't get too distracted by that. But what's implied by this particular presentation of Africa, however inaccurate it might be, what's different, right, between this one and this one? Here's Africa here. In Ptolemy's understanding, here's Africa in the Muslim understanding of 1154. What's different? Alexander?
It's surrounded by water.
Yeah.
That was perfectly smooth.
See the water over here? Yeah, it goes all the way around. So Africa's not the end of the world in some sense. There's water around it. In, at least, as Alexander says, it's perfectly smooth, like it's perfectly round, exactly distant from the edge of the world. So it's not meant, it's not really a claim to knowledge. It's more a kind of premise, right? That says, Africa can be sailed around. It's a landmass like any other, and basically, in principle, it should be possible to get around it. It's obvious that they hadn't, right? Because if they had gotten around it, the map wouldn't look like this, right? They wouldn't be making this mistake of treating it like it's a circular shape, right? Like that. But it's a representation of a belief, of a promise that it could be done, though nobody had obviously done it. So this is what Prince Henry was excited about. Because, now I'm going to go to an objective representation of the world here. An actual representation, right? Including, well, we got this stuff that we don't know about yet. Okay, but zooming in here on the old world again, and taking us back to this kind of conception of Europe's over here, China's over here, and if you're going to follow the Silk Route, well, you know, you go from here to here, and there's really only one way. You got to go through the Middle East, and the Muslims control that. So that's one way. The Muslims are always going to be your middlemen if you want to trade with Asia, according to this method. But if Prince Henry, who's studying the science of geography, is thinking about the world, and it is, in principle, looking at the shape of the world and thinking, okay, let's work on this again here. We've got Europe over here, and we've got China over here. Now, is there a way that Portugal can become the middleman? It must have been one of those moments, like when the apple fell on Newton in front of Newton, or Newton's head, depending on the version of the story, right? It must have been one of those eureka moments like Archimedes had, right? How can Portugal be in the middle? How can Portugal be in the middle? Well, if you sail from China to Europe, what's the first country you run into? If you go this way, China, who's in the middle? Portugal! China, Portugal, Europe! Hello, who's the middleman? Portugal! Not the Muslim world over here, the enemies of Portugal. They're only in the middle if you're going by land. If you're going by sea, all of a sudden, Portugal is the middleman. Yeah, what a fantastic concept! You could become the Amazon of the Dark Ages, now the Walmart of the Dark Ages, if you could just figure out a way of sailing around this big hunk of land over here that's in the way. But how are you going to do that? You're going to have to go and be Greek again. How can you learn about the world that you live in? You can't just go back to ancient maps. You can't just study things that other people learned. What do you have to do? Alexander?
Explore and learn it yourself.
Explore and learn yourself. Because they only got so far in this story. They didn't learn everything there was to learn. Nobody had learned exactly what the world looked like yet. So if you want to do it, you're going to have to leave Portugal, and you're going to have to go down here, and that's partly what this map shows. Unfortunately, these annotations have gotten in the way a little bit. But basically, you're going to have to crawl down the coast here as far as you can go, and keep going and keep going, and find out what this thing called Africa looks like. And as you can see down here, I'll post this map on the class webpage as well, without the green lines to distract you. By 1445, the Portuguese had gotten to a particularly interesting spot. They had gotten to a place called Cape Verde. They named it that. And it's an important location because if you're trying to get to China and you're not Columbus, well, what you know is, what you know about China is, it's what direction? Yes, verde is the same in Spanish and Portuguese, Bria. It means green. Okay, but where's China, Alexander?
To the east.
To the east, okay. So if you're Portugal and you want to get to China, but you're not Columbus, then you don't want to be going this way. West. That's the wrong way. If you're not Columbus. Right, so sailing around, sailing down this way is not exactly what you want, is it? Because it's going south, but it's also going west, which is pretty annoying and troubling because it's not the way you want to go. So getting here is a big accomplishment in your understanding of geography and how willing you are to keep on exploring, right? Because Cape Verde is the westernmost point of Africa. Once you get past this, you're still going south for a long time, but you're going east again. You're finally going in the direction that you want to go. Because that's where you want to go. You're Portuguese. You're not Columbus. You don't want to go west. So this is really important. And Prince Henry and his explorers are doing their best. And it's really kind of hard to imagine how big of a deal it was for them to get here. If you look at the scale of this, look how far it is to get from Portugal to England. Which was about as far as anybody traveled in this point. And now look how far it is to go to a completely unknown location. It's much further to go just to get to Cape Verde than it is just to get to England, which you know how to get. So extremely great distances for them to have to travel. Very arduous, very difficult. In Prince Henry's time, they managed to get all the way down here to this part of the world, which is called the Gulf of Guinea. So they did manage to get around this hump, this western part of Africa that really sticks out over here, and discover a fair amount of the geography. And so Prince Henry had a map commissioned, which is known as the Frau Moro map. And it's very much like the Al-Idrisi map in orientation and in content, right? If we look here on our Frau Moro map, again, we have, pardon me, oopsie, stop. All right, sometimes annotations here are less than easy to do. Okay, so again, here we have Italy. Right, here we have England. Here we have Ireland. All right, so there's the coast of Europe. Right, and yeah, we still have Sri Lanka over here, really huge next to India, because nobody's figured out any better than that right now, right? But look at Africa. We have the premise of circumnavigability, right? The idea that you can get around it. And we have this idea that you could, that maybe, you know, they've drawn this Gulf of Guinea stuff here. So you can get around Cape Verde and you can get to this part of it. So there was still some notion that maybe you could get through the center of Africa and there might be a shortcut through land. But, you know, the question was exactly how do we do it? We don't know yet. By the time of Christopher Columbus, they still hadn't fully answered the question. By the time of Christopher Columbus, the Portuguese had managed to get here. Or in reality, right, if we're going to be really objective about it, they had managed to get here, which is the real shape of Africa, down here, which is called the Cape of Good Hope down there in South Africa. So, in Prince Henry's time, they still hadn't made it. But they were working on it really, really hard. It was extremely difficult. And Columbus was trying to tell people, well, maybe there's a better way. This could take you 6 months. Maybe there's a better way. So on Monday, Columbus arrives on the scene. He's talking to all those monarchs, all those modern-day European Menes Narmer types, and saying, give me permission to go and see if I can do this. If I go over here and keep going around a round planet, well, guess where I'll end up? Maybe it's shorter than going this way. Turns out it's not. But how could you know? How could anybody know? The only way to know was to go and try. And thank you, Columbus, for being that kind of person. Because as a result, you landed in the Americas and a whole new world was revealed to Europeans. And the story of the world is going to be completely different from now on. All right, so we'll get to Columbus on Monday, talk about his revelation to the world, and then we're going to be getting closer and closer to Europeans actually coming to America, settling here, bringing new ideas, bringing the ideas of Europe, bringing the ideas of ancient Greece and Rome, and there's going to be a new place for them to try them out. A new freer place for them to experiment without the kings and queens of Europe looking over their shoulder and working until such time as the idea of freedom from ancient Greece and Rome has been sufficiently revived in people's thinking about life that it can be tried again. And there's a place where it can be done. If somebody's brave enough to overthrow monarchy and create a new birth of freedom. All right, we'll get there. We'll get there. That's it, though, for me for today. Tomorrow, of course, is History Through Art. So thanks, everybody. Talk to you then. Bye for now.
Bye, Mr. Fatwell.
Bye.
All right, bye guys.
It's me, bye.